It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Later on Central Time, we'll learn about some of the best places to check out fall colors in the state. That's coming up in our Curious Wisconsin segment.
But first, we turn to some major news happening in Green Bay. The Leo Frigo Bridge, one of the most important thoroughfares in northeastern Wisconsin, has been closed indefinitely after a large sag was discovered on Wednesday morning.
The bridge is part of I-43. It carries about 40,000 vehicles a day. An investigation into the bridge is underway by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
Joining us now is Patty Murray. She's WPR's reporter in Green Bay, and she's been following the story. Patty, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
All right, so the Department of Transportation is reporting what they're calling a sag in the Leo Frigo Bridge. Can you tell us a bit about what's happening there?
Actually, the DOT did just hold another media briefing that I tuned into online. It just wound up a few minutes ago. And this sag is between 27 and 22 inches. I'll give you a picture of the bridge for somebody who may not be that familiar with it. It is a four-lane bridge, so two lanes in each direction. Part of the bridge is sagging 27 inches. Part of it's sagging 22 inches. Either way, it's enough to shut the thing down. And like you said, we don't really know when this thing is going to reopen. They did say that the DOT, the State Department of Transportation, is bringing on extra staffers, and the Federal Highway Administration is involved, obviously, since it's an interstate highway. So those two clues tell me it's not going to open anytime soon. That's speculation on my part, but if you've seen pictures of this sag, the bridge almost looks like a piece of ribbon candy.
Which is, the word sag is not, of course, what you want associated with a major, supposedly solid piece of infrastructure.
It does not inspire confidence.
How alarming is it, do you think?
Well, it's obviously nobody was injured, and that's the main point. I mean, all of our minds, I think, when we hear about bridge problems like this go back to, I think it was about 6 years ago in Minneapolis when the interstate bridge there did collapse and people were killed. So nothing like that happened here, thank God. And when I was at the media briefing yesterday, the DOT officials made the point over and over again that this bridge is not in danger of collapsing, but they want everybody to stay off of it. They don't want anybody to even walk on the bridge. They don't want anybody to go underneath the bridge because the piers, what we would think of as a pillar or a column, those are technically called piers, and that one of those piers has failed somehow. It's either sunk into the ground or something has happened to this pier, and that is what has led to this sag.
Now, can you give us a sense of just how important the Leo Frigo Bridge is to Green Bay?
Well, Green Bay is cut in half by the Fox River. And so your east side or west side, for example, I live on the west side. I work on the east side. So you got to get from here to there. So it's going to take a little bit longer without this this bridge, because the other bridges through town, there are three more in the city of Green Bay. There is a highway bridge that runs through like De Pere and Ashwaubenon. But the three bridges within the city of Green Bay, kind of what we would think of as the downtown area, those are drawbridges. So you never know. It's still shipping season. The drawbridge can open up, and on top of that, what we call in Green Bay the double whammy. You got a train track in front of the drawbridge, so you can have a train going by, which happened to me this morning. So you're stuck waiting for the train to go by, which is fine. It's all part of commerce. But then you also have the possibility of the drawbridge going up. So people really need to drive the town. They need to get an alternate route for the foreseeable future or unforeseeable future.
Well, this is part of I-43. People who might be heading past Green Bay, is this going to affect a lot of travelers who are looking to get through Green Bay onward up toward, I don't know, Door County or somewhere?
Well, that's another fun part of the story. Maybe not Door County, because you could scoot around this and easily go up Interstate 43, no problem. People who want to go up and see the beautiful leaves and maybe visit a few apple orchards in Door County or something like that, no problem. If, however, you're going to be heading up for, like, deer hunting or something, like toward Marinette or the Upper Peninsula toward northern Wisconsin, mm-hmm. on the west side of the bay, there is also a major reconstruction project going on for Highway 41, State Highway 41. And so there are some lane restrictions, and sometimes, usually overnight, they're even closing off portions of the highway there. So there you go.
Now, you're describing kind of a traffic, nightmare. I've been in Green Bay, but I can't remember how heavy traffic is there. How big a deal do you expect this to be to commuters every day?
Well, to commuters. I mean, I think commuters and...
Or just people getting to their jobs and their homes.
Oh, I don't think anybody's been impeded from getting to work. I mean, I don't think it's, you know, it's not to that extent. It's an inconvenience, but... You know, as I said before, you know, nobody was injured, nobody got killed or anything like that. So it's just something, yeah, you got to deal with it.
Now, there was, as I understand it, some construction sort of shoring up various parts of the same bridge earlier this year. So I take it whatever happened there was not enough to stop this sag from happening. Do you know what they did earlier and how it might have affected the sag now?
They were doing some deck repair, some painting of the bridge to prevent rusting, you know, things like that. So it was kind of typical maintenance that would happen on a bridge. And I did ask the DOT officials about that yesterday. I said, hey, you know, did this deck repair have anything to do with it? Because I remember with that I-35 or 35W in Minneapolis that... They said that some of that, you know, you're just putting asphalt on top of asphalt on top of asphalt to repair the roadway, the deck, and I think there was some sort of concern that that might have weighted the bridge down. It's too early to say anything about that with this Leo Frigo I-43 bridge here in Green Bay.
Okay, and last quick question. Is this going to mean anything for Packer fans who are trying to get to Green Bay to see a game?
I just talked to somebody from the Green Bay Visitors and Convention Bureau today, and his quote was, people would crawl to get to a Green Bay Packer game.
And will they have to?
I don't think so.
Okay, well, we'll have to wait and see. Keep us in touch about this one, Patty.
I shall.
All right. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That was Patty Murray, WPR's reporter in Green Bay. For more coverage on this story, Joy Cardine will be talking with Wisconsin Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb. That's coming up Tuesday at 7 o'clock next week.
Coming up next, we'll hear about some of the best places in the state to see fall colors.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
As we move from September into October, the leaves are starting to change colors around Wisconsin.
It's kind of the best part of the season, other than the return, of course, of pumpkin-flavored everything, in my personal opinion.
Looking forward to pie.
That's good, too. Well, here to tell us about some of the places in the Badger State to see fall colors, maybe you can bring your pie along, Rob, is Robert Zimmer, garden and outdoors writer for the Appleton Post-Crescent. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
So we've heard that the fall colors are coming a bit earlier this year. What are we seeing so far?
There's not much yet around the area I'm in. I've heard they're going to be right on time. They're just starting to turn around central Wisconsin here where I live.
And when do they usually peak?
They're actually pretty close to the first, second week of October. They start farther north, and then you go south, and they cycle through the end of October. But around my area, about the second week of October, and I'm in the Appleton area.
So you wrote a piece on some of the most spectacular places around the state to check out fall colors. Can you give us some of your favorites?
Sure. Some of my favorites are, I like out-of-the-way places. I don't like to send people to the, you know, the main big places that everyone goes, but I like Horicon Marsh, which obviously isn't an out-of-the-way place, but people don't usually think of Horicon Marsh as a fall color area. They think of the geese and things like that, but there's actually a lot of really pretty color there. The Niagara Escarpment runs across the eastern edge of the marsh and then down to the south, and that's a beautiful area to visit.
What is the Niagara Escarpment?
It's the ledge that makes up Niagara Falls. It makes up the Kettle Moraine all the way through Door County. It's the big limestone ledge that makes up pretty much circles through the whole eastern half of the state, all the way up through Upper Michigan, makes a loop back down to Niagara Falls.
Now, obviously, lots of people have favorite fall color viewing points, and we want to hear what those are. You can add to this conversation with Robert Zimmer as we talk about some of his favorites. Why don't you join and tell us some of yours at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, just like Jake did, and he recommends Devil's Lake for fall color viewing. Have you been there, Robert?
Yep, Devil's Lake is beautiful, especially a little bit later. The second or third week in October, a lot of beautiful scenery there. Plus, you get the whole the scenic view from the top of the peak there.
The tricky thing is walking on the bluff paths with lots of dry leaves on the ground.
Right.
I have found it
worse when they're wet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wet or dry leaves. I find it a bit harrowing walking with the kids up and down those. We've survived every event, and the view is spectacular. I agree. That's a great place to see the fall colors.
It is, yep. And there's a state park here near Appleton called High Cliff State Park, which is similar. It's got, again, the Niagara Escarpment runs right there along Lake Winnebago. It's got the high cliff there. Lots of those steep ledges that you're talking about, slippery, but just beautiful as far as the scenery.
So when you're at Devil's Lake, are you kind of looking down on the canopy of leaves?
You can, yeah, from up
you
in
can.
The bluff. Yeah,
that would be a different experience. I'm used to, one
right.
of my favorite fall experiences is walking through where the trees kind of arch over, and there's, you're sort of in this cathedral of leaves and color. I've had that at Door County before, but it would be something different to have to look down on them and see just the wash of them below you.
Yeah, well, now that you say that, another great place to do that is Rib Mountain State Park in Wausau. What you can actually do at Granite Peak there is take the ski lifts up during fall, and you're actually, you know, you take the ski lift up the mountain, and you're looking down at the colors. That's just amazing. And that goes on every weekend, I think through the second or third week in October.
You know, one place I haven't been in the fall, the highest point in Wisconsin, Timms Hill? Is that
it? Yeah, I haven't been there either. Not in fall, anyway.
I've been there in the summer, and it's an amazing view. And every time I've been there, I think, I got to come here in the fall someday because you could see a long way. I think it would be probably pretty spectacular.
Yeah, that'd be beautiful. Yeah. A couple other places, obviously you mentioned Door County. There's a lot of beautiful places in Door County to go besides the obvious state parks. There's Cave Point County Park, which is a smaller park there right along the lake where the waves come in and create like caves in the limestone. And again, that's the same Niagara Escarpment we talked about.
Oh, sorry, where was that one again?
It's called Cave Point County Park in Door County.
In Door County. Okay, wow. Yeah. So there are, even though we know a general place, there might be an especially, you know, neat, out-of-the-way place like that that people like.
Right, and that's what I prefer because, you know, you're by yourself, and some of the roads leading to Cave Point are just beautiful. You go down these winding roads leading to the park, and just gorgeous with the maples and everything hanging over, like you mentioned, the cathedral of leaves that you're driving through.
Again,
and that's just north of... Oh, sorry.
But that's okay. Again, if you have a favorite place to go see leaves, if you've seen them from Timms Hill in the fall changing, maybe along the Mississippi, some of the areas we haven't talked about, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or share your favorite place to see leaves, or maybe you've got a picture from last year, you can go to the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR.
Now, here's something I wonder. I don't want to put you on the spot, Robert, but, you know, we always hear about Vermont. Vermont is where you go to see great colors. Do you have any sense about how Wisconsin stacks up against Vermont?
I think I've never been to Vermont. I've seen pictures, but there's areas in Wisconsin that either stack up quite well or beat it. I mean, there are some really beautiful places, especially in northern Wisconsin, around Marinette County, up by Copper Falls State Park, along the Lake Superior shore, Door County, obviously. I think we come close, if not beating it in some places.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Jeff in Green Bay on the line. Jeff, hi.
Hello. I was just going to suggest there are several county parks in Marinette County that involve waterfalls that the fall leaves are a great backdrop to the waterfalls, like 12-foot falls and Dave's Falls.
Yes, I agree. That's one of my favorite places to see the fall colors up in Marinette County by all the waterfalls. And there's a lot, like you said, and they're all within walking distance of parking areas, so it's not really hard to get there. Some of them, there's a steep climb to get down to the falls themselves if you want to walk right up to them, but it's a beautiful area. Like, that's what I was going to say, comparing to Vermont. The whole Marinette County area is just gorgeous.
And hey, Jeff, is that bridge closure going to make it harder for you to get up there to Marinette County?
I usually take 172 over, so
you're clean.
Not in my case, but people live on the north side of Green Bay, it might be a little more problematic.
All right, thanks a lot for the call, Jeff.
And let's go next to Kathy, who's joining us in Catawba. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How about you?
Good. I just wanted to say you really need to come up and see Tim's Hill. It is absolutely beautiful. And this morning, I think someone was talking about rustic roads in Wisconsin, and there's a rustic road right up in that same area.
What are the colors like, though, in the fall? I've been there in the summer, but what is it like
absolutely
to be up on the observation tower?
Absolutely gorgeous. I've never been all the way up on the observation tower, but just on the road itself, and then there's a couple of lakes there, too. And so the reflections of the trees and that are just absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like this coupling of water and leaves. It's something I haven't thought a lot, but seeing a waterfall with the leaves sounds just like a little bit of nature perfection for you right there, especially since winter is coming and it makes it more poignant.
All right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rob.
Sorry. I was just going to say, Jeff, who mentioned the Marinette County waterfalls, there's also a couple of huge flowages up there where it's called High Falls Flowage and Caldron Falls Flowage, which are just these pristine lakes. They just made a new state park there, Governor Thompson State Park and the Peshtigo River State Forest. But on that lake, you were talking about the water. Well, there's these huge granite outcroppings that stand up over the water, you know, 100 feet or more. And that reflected on the water below with the colors is just amazing. The oaks and the maples and the hickories and things like that reflected over the water on a calm day.
All right, well, let's get another comment here from Facebook. Susie in New Berlin says, go to Grant Park in South Milwaukee. It has 7 bridges, and it's a beautiful walk. And I like how she's recommending a walk instead of a stationary place, too, because it's lovely to just move through and see all the different varieties of trees and all the different colors. It's a fantastic idea. What about Milwaukee, Robert?
Yeah, but the nice thing about the whole Lake Michigan shoreline from the border all the way up to Door County is it's actually usually about a week or two behind the rest of the state because the effects of the lake actually stabilize the trees there, so they actually come into peak later than they do normally. So it's a great place to get down there, and you don't have to rush. You know, you can go see all the other places and then go down to Milwaukee along the lakeshore and still get all the fall color. There's a lot of pretty places down there all along the lake. They have the huge weeping willows right there in Milwaukee that all turn golden yellow in fall, and it's just gorgeous through there.
Mm. That sounds fantastic.
We have a comment from the booth here. Our on-air producer, Cynthia Schuster, says, last year I had a friend visiting from London. We went to Devil's Lake and Peninsula State Park to look at the fall colors. My friend was so impressed by the variety of colors we get here. He says he doesn't see colors like ours in London or in his home country of South Africa. So, all right, internationally acclaimed leaves here in Wisconsin, Robert.
Yes. And that's because of our whole climate, the glaciers, everything has to do with that. We have a nice, Wisconsin sits right at that tension zone where we're between the southern deciduous forest and the northern boreal forest. We have a huge variety of trees here, and, you know, they cycle into their season at different times throughout the fall. So you start with some of the ashes and maples, and then the oaks, well, the oaks actually come last, and then you have the tamaracks, too, which are actually evergreen trees that actually change color and drop their leaves in the fall. Those are actually my favorite fall tree.
And, Robert, time is running out on us here, but you want to leave us with one more very quick recommendation?
I like Navarino Wildlife Area, which is just south of Shawano. It's a huge area at 15,000 acres. There's just huge rolling sandhills that go up and down throughout that whole area, and you're just walking among these, you know, towering oaks and hickories and maples, and the color there is just amazing. And speaking of tamaracks, there's huge stands of tamarack there, too, that change to a really bright gold later in October and into November.
All right. Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Robert Zimmer, garden and outdoors writer for the Appleton Post-Crescent.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about the history of apples and what to do with them now that it's apple season.
We'll also talk to news guy Noah Ovsinski about the top stories from around Wisconsin this week.
And is civility on the decline in the United States? A recent survey says it is, and we'll find out what you think and how we can improve things.
We hope you'll join us for all that tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up next, people suffering from psychosis used to think the CIA was spying on them. Now they often think they're on a reality TV show. We'll find out why after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Schizophrenia is a condition that often involves delusions and paranoia. It affects roughly 1% of the population.
And while the symptoms of the condition haven't changed, the nature of it has changed with the times.
Andrew Morantz joins us to explain what's going on. He's an editor and writer at The New Yorker. He has a recent piece called Unreality Star. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So to set the stage, describe what schizophrenia is and paranoid schizophrenia as you wrote about it. What are some of the basic symptoms?
Well, there are a whole range of schizoid disorders, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, that, you know, involve hallucinations, delusions, detachment from reality. You know, we've given different names to this kind of cluster of symptoms over time, but there have always been people for reasons that are largely unknown who perceive kind of an entire coherent reality that's separate from the reality that many other people perceive.
And the thing you write about is that the way that reality manifests itself has changed over time. It's not the same for everybody. It's not the same now as it was, say, a couple decades ago.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, our beliefs are always changing because of the input that we're getting from our society. You know, that includes rational and irrational beliefs. That includes, you know, every belief that we have, and this includes delusional beliefs, which are beliefs that people hold contrary to evidence. So, yeah, the things that are that you perceive and see in the world around you enter your psyche and come out in all kinds of unpredictable ways.
And it's fascinating to me because I think of something like schizophrenia as, I guess, maybe hardwired, and it affects your brain in a certain way, but it's really an interaction between the condition and the culture around us.
That's absolutely true. There are many ways in which it's an interaction, some of which are so deep, you know, epigenetics and in utero environment that I didn't even get into them in the piece. But one very easy way that we can conceive of the interaction is just in terms of form versus content. So there are certain forms that mental illness has always taken in society, but the content of those delusions is always going to change. It's kind of a old wine and new bottles kind of situation.
So what has been the change in the last few decades? What did people a generation or two ago believe was happening to them versus what they believe now often?
Well, there were people during the Cold War who thought that Soviet satellites were controlling their thoughts through radio waves. There were people. I mean, this basically happens every time there's a major technological shift in society. You know, when the telegraph was invented, there were people who thought that their thoughts were being broadcast through that. The telephone, same thing. It's kind of a natural response if you're a person who's prone to seeing threats everywhere, that all of a sudden there's a powerful new instrument that has never existed before. You know, your brain might leap to, what if this is used to do me harm? Of course, now we have things like the NSA tapping our phones. We have drones everywhere. We have space satellites in wide use. These things are all really happening, and so it's just a slight imaginative leap to think about how they could be used to harm an individual.
Well, and a natural fit, and this is what you write about most, is reality TV.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, in the human psyche, it's always been tempting to imagine oneself as a celebrity, and nowadays anyone can be a celebrity. I mean, with, you know, ever since The Real World, and arguably, you know, it's taken off hugely since then, you know, you can be, it's kind of like, well, there's no reason Snooki should be a big celebrity and I shouldn't, you know, so there are certain people whose brains tell them, well, you are, you know, you already are, and the cameras are being kept secret from you, but they're there, and that explains why things kind of feel so weird in your life.
Now, you focus on one person who has been through this, and you met him, actually, toward the end of your research, it sounds like. Can you tell his story and how this reality TV concept played out in his life?
Sure. Well, Nick Lotz was going through college, kind of, you know, smart, normal kid who sort of more and more got the impression that people were kind of talking about him behind his back, maybe looking at him funny, which is an impression that people sometimes have, but the paranoia sort of started sliding more and more out of control. And in a way, his brain kind of put together an explanation of why are people looking at me funny, you know, why do people sort of seem to stop when I walk in the room? And the thing that he hit on was, oh, I must be famous and they must be broadcasting a 24-hour reality show about me and people must be looking at me because of that. And then from there, his brain was able to spin out a fabulous confabulation that took over his life for about 2.5 years, where he felt 24 hours a day that he was being broadcast and that he was a national celebrity. And it included everything from, you know, the internet he was looking at was a fake version of the internet that that had been scrubbed of fan websites about him. You know, people were plants that were put there by the producers of the show. So it really consumed his life. And if you think about it, it really could have been true. I mean, there are more boring reality shows than that.
Mm. And eventually he started playing to the cameras.
Yeah, he wanted to be a good participant. I mean, there was prize money involved, so he wanted to succeed. He didn't want to get recast. So he tried to play into it. He took acting classes so he could make his performance better. He thought pretty deeply about plot structure and how to move the plot forward. And, you know, in the kind of Shakespearean all the world's a stage kind of way, it's kind of just a slightly more self-conscious version of what we all do, right? Try to move the plot forward every day in our lives. He was just doing it for his audience.
And we hear often in some cases of mental illness, the cliche, he heard voices. The voices he heard were producers of the show. Is that right?
Yeah, that's not a cliche. That's a common symptom. And a big feature of this is that you have the symptom and then you retroactively try to justify what it means, kind of like in a dream. And so he would hear voices telling him to do things or go certain places, and he would say, oh, that must be the producers of my show, and they're giving me instructions over this little wireless microphone, which, again, you know, kind of a more parsimonious explanation for it than some other people have invented.
So when people in his family, his friends, confronted him with the thought that he might have a mental illness, he accused them of going off script. How did people convince him to seek treatment, which you found out he did?
It's hard. It's hard to convince someone of something like that, especially because he didn't want to break the fourth wall. You know, if you're in a successful reality show, the first thing they're going to edit out is anyone talking too explicitly about the making of the reality show. So you don't want to look directly at the camera. You don't want to say, boy, I'm tired of being under these lights. You know, you want to play it cool. So he didn't really want to talk about it with anyone, and it took a lot of gentle coaxing and prodding and, frankly, just pure luck for his parents to be able to sort of gently say, hey, do you want to see a doctor? And he kept saying, no, 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 no. And eventually, you know, there were successful interventions. But yeah, it was dicey there for a while.
You met him, I think it was in December. How did he talk about, looking back, his life as a reality TV star?
He's a very funny, self-aware, smart guy. He's had a pretty heroic struggle with his delusions, and he's kind of wrestled them to the ground now. But he's pretty funny about the whole thing. I mean, he would, you know, we would drive by a field, and he would say, "Oh, that's where the producers made me, you know, put my underwear on my head and run around in circles because they wanted, you know, they wanted an episode about that." Or he would say, "You know, this is Court Street. So this was the street where everyone was a judge and I was a jury," or, you know, he remembers things with pretty vivid detail. And he, you know, he, it's like, it's this terrifying thing that he doesn't make light of. But then again, it's, you know, he recognizes that it's a notable and sort of, you know, interesting and quirky thing that happened to him. So he's willing to share immense detail about it.
You write that psychiatry as a profession is now less interested in the form that schizophrenia takes when it exhibits itself and looks more at the root causes. Is anyone still studying how this manifestation changes over time?
Sure, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's coming more into vogue that people are studying all sides of this. And there's so much yet to be studied that, we don't understand physically what's going on or sociologically what's going on. But yeah, I think that, there was a pendulum shift pretty far toward the pure biology orientation. And now people are coming to recognize that, we do need to study the patterns of delusional content if we want to more fully understand the illness and our society itself.
I don't know if you went back this far, but are people thinking if you go back far enough, the explanation instead of the CIA or reality TV might have been witchcraft?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's not only a past thing. I mean, there are entire cultures where people don't talk in terms of medicalized mental illness. They talk in terms of prophets and witches and demons and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, that goes on even now.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
This is Andrew Marantz. He's a writer and editor for The New Yorker.
Coming up, NPR Science Friday's Ira Flatto tells us how to make science sexy. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next guest is a familiar voice to public radio listeners. For decades, Ira Flatto has been covering the world of science for NPR, all the while making it fun and accessible. He served as NPR science correspondent and is now best known as the host of Science Friday.
He's in the state this week for the Wisconsin Science Festival. He's a featured speaker tonight at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery. He'll be broadcasting Science Friday from there tomorrow.
Ira Flatto joins us in the studio now. Ira, welcome to Central Time.
So nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, as we said, you're here in Madison for the Wisconsin Science Festival, and we checked out your keynote talk. You're going to be talking about science is sexy.
Yes.
So how about it? Why is science sexy?
I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
What TV show are you going to watch on Sunday that the rest of the country is going to stay glued to at the same time?
Is there a Packers game?
Hey, after the game. Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad. You a Breaking Bad fan? Breaking Bad has its last episode this Sunday, and the star of Breaking Bad, or the person, is a chemistry teacher. He's a chemistry teacher, the number one, the highest rated show ever on cable television features a chemistry teacher as its lead character.
I have to admit, I haven't seen that one. I've been reading all of the commentary on it. I don't have access to it yet. But does Breaking Bad make chemistry cool? Do they actually get into the chemistry?
They get it. They actually have someone who is a scientist who makes sure that the chemicals, the equations that they do and the chemistry that they do is very accurate. And the most popular show on CBS, comedy, which show is that? You know what that is?
Oh, I have a hint about this one. Big Bang Theory.
That's right. So now we have the two most popular shows that have to do with science as a theme. Physics and, you know, physics geeks in the Big Bang Theory. And I was very happy that I was on the Big Bang Theory for an episode. Sheldon was on Science Friday once. And Breaking Bad, which is the most popular show on all of cable. So you have cable, you have a standard network television with science themes in them. Science is actually sexy. People are putting science in the media. When shows that have to make money, and we follow the money all the time, decide that they'll make more money by putting science as a theme, or at least part of it, to me, science is coming back. It may not. Studies are showing that people are not learning their science in school anymore. The majority of people learn their science in informal science education, whether it's on Science Friday or on these TV shows, or they go to the museum and they go to the zoo, they go to the science center, and they're going there in droves. They cannot get enough science.
Well, I guess a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, and that's part of it. It is great to get your science in Breaking Bad. But since we mentioned Big Bang Theory, we happen to have pulled a clip where guess who is guest starring on it. It's you, and a little setup here. There we have Sheldon in a room. He's being interviewed by you for the show, and one of his fellows plays a prank on him and fills the room with a certain gas. Let's take a listen.
This is Ira Flatto, and you're listening to NPR's Science Friday. Joining us today by phone from his office in Pasadena, California, is Dr. Sheldon Cooper.
This is going to be a Wyatt.
Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Cooper.
My pleasure, Ira.
Now let's talk about magnetic monopoles. Can you explain to our audience just what a monopole is?
Of course. First, consider an ordinary magnet, which has, as even the most uneducated in your audience must know, two poles.
North and South Pole. If you cut that in half, you have two smaller magnets, each with its own North and South Pole.
Dr. Cooper, I think there might be something wrong with our connection.
No, I hear you fine.
I love that clip, and I've heard it three times today.
Yeah, well, it's good. I know it's on, and people stop me on the street and say, I've seen the rerun. You know?
Yeah.
And I actually went out to the set a couple of weeks ago. We were out in California, and I visited them, watching them record. We're actually doing the walkthrough of the Big Bang Theory, and they were very nice. And the writers who were responsible for the dialogue and whatever were coming over to me to pitch story ideas for Science Friday. Hey, did you know about this? They're actually,
wow.
Because they come up with story ideas for the show, they're very well immersed in
and
it.
And that's how you know science is coming back, as you
yes.
said.
Yes, well, you know, it's coming back in a lot of different ways. You have the science festival here in town. There are at least a dozen other ones around the country where there never used to be any. The first one was started in Cambridge a few years ago, and it caught on. And they're in cities and towns all over the world. People love the science festivals. They go to these things called maker fairs. You know, Maker Faire.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah. There are tens of thousands of people come out on weekends and they watch other people make their inventions. You know, I think the spread of the 3D printer got started at Maker Faires. Right?
Well, isn't it interesting that people are doing it themselves now? I mean, maybe we used to feel like it was something that had to be done by someone with a white coat in a lab in a hermetically sealed place and a, you know, pocket protector was probably involved. But
I
now,
have one for you, the Science Friday logo, if you'd like one.
Yeah. Of course I'd like one. Yeah, but now it seems like people are doing it in their garages and teaming up with people online to solve problems and use groupthink. I mean, why do you think this is happening now? What forces came together?
Well, I think the internet made it possible. I mean, the crowdsourcing stuff. People are they're citizen science, as you referred to them, they're called citizen scientists, and they're being asked to solve problems. For example, there's something called protein folding. A protein, for it to operate correctly, is actually folded up, and it has to unfold and fold itself back. If it doesn't fold itself back, that's what may cause some illnesses. So they want to figure out how a protein folds. It's actually a three-dimensional object. And even though we have all these supercomputers, the human brain is still the best at looking at, you know, rotating objects in your mind and making, where we are still the best at that. So what they have done now is crowdsource protein folding. They'll ask the public, we have this protein, can you figure out how it folds, and put it on a website, and they'll get 100,000 people to look at it. And I remember there were up to 70,000 at one point, 70,000 people looking at this, and they came to us and they said, you have a lot of people on Science Friday, can you just say we need a few more people to look at this? And we gave them 30,000 more people. And they went in and they solved this protein folding problem.
Wow.
In this case. So I think the internet has brought everybody together and shown that you know, citizens can be scientists and do all kinds of stuff.
And the scientific community is okay with this. They're saying hands off.
No.
This is, you know, for us only.
They
welcome this.
You know, they do it not just with proteins, but there have been galaxies and things. You know how boring it is to look through a star chart of just little white dots on all these negatives that come out of telescopes? So they themselves, I think, are surprised of how much time people will take to just look at these boring charts and find something that's out there that they have never discovered before.
Now, are these people, these citizen scientists, are they trained at all? Or is this something that, you
know,
they just got an aptitude, they're interested, and so they just take
they'll train
swing
you.
At it?
They'll train you for what you need to know. If you know, it's not hard to look at two slides and see if a dot has moved on it from one place to another to see if something is moving out in the stars. But there is a debate going on as we speak about how much training should we give, you know, people to crowdsource this information? Question of, can it be politicized? What if the politics gets involved and people start to skew the data because they want it to show something? So it's now in its infancy, but, you know, citizen science is here. And people, everything from going out looking at leaves to discovering new species.
And Science Friday is part of that right now. I mean, you've talked about so many interesting things recently on the show. You've talked about volcanoes and we've talked about going beyond the solar system for the first time. How does it feel to be at the cusp of what seems to be, you know, something that's really exciting and cool happening in our culture, this reawakening of science nerds?
Yeah, we're very happy to be there. You know, we've been doing this for 22 years now. And so we've watched the evolution of the interest. We've watched the evolution of science. We've watched the evolution of evolution and how it's played out in the public. We always knew that science, the public loved science. All the studies you show that the public loves science. They may not know what a scientist does, and most of them don't when you look at the studies, but they know that they love science, and they know that science and technology is very important to them. If you just give them the opportunity to hear about it, they will flock in droves to you. We have, of all the public radio shows on all the public radio stations, Science Friday has the largest social community of anybody. You know,
really?
We have 400,000 Twitter members. We have over 100,000, you know, Facebook members. Not somebody's individual tweets, but the show itself. We have the highest rated, the highest number of members in all of public radio. It's because people love the stuff. We don't make them love the stuff. Everybody starts out inherently as a scientist. All kids, when they're little, they're all scientists. You know, when you take a Pop-Tart and you want to stick it in the VCR, you know, because it looks like it should fit in there or something, you are trying an experiment, right?
I think my kids have done that.
Yes,
yeah.
you're trying an experiment, and we have to find a way of channeling that inquisitiveness and creativity so that kids don't lose it, or we don't make them lose it when they get into school.
Now, I got to call you out. I think you're being a little modest there. You said people love science. I'm not going to challenge you on that, but I think there is something special that Science Friday does, and that is you take these concepts, which can be kind of mind-blowing and cause the human brain to just shut down out of fear, and you make it accessible.
Well, I think what we don't do is we're not condescending. We don't tell you you're just not smart enough to understand this thing. We're going to find a way that if I can understand it and I can explain it to my producer or someone else, if I can understand it enough, you are smart enough, because I'm certainly not smart enough. And if I can understand it, you can understand it. It's just finding a way of explaining it the right way, because there's not a lot of complicated stuff that goes on here. You have to pull away a little bit of the layers to find the simple part. But basically, people are looking and answering the questions that we've all asked, that theologians and philosophers have asked. Where did we come from and where are we going? And science is that way to find out.
Well, we're talking right now with Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday on NPR. He's in town for the Wisconsin Science Festival. They'll be doing a live broadcast tomorrow, by the way, here in Madison. And we've got details about the keynote speech and that live broadcast on the Central Time Facebook page.
And if you have a question for Ira Flatow, give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll pick up the discussion right after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.